illustration of this theme of Bible's penchant for teaching doctrine in terms of its polarities, one I knew that would keep us awake at the end of a long morning, and that is the continuum in biblical teaching of human sensuality with its two opposite poles, chastity and modesty on the one hand, the spirituality required of Christians in their lives, and the celebration of physical beauty and sexual pleasure on the other end of this pole. Now the first pole, chastity, modesty, the emphasis on spiritual character and traits is found everywhere, and it's found emphatically in Holy Scripture. However impolitic it may be to emphasize it in our day, in our culture, the Bible commands us to live chastely and modestly. It forbids fornication and adultery. It is pitiless in its condemnation of people who commit these sins. We have a large class of texts that teach us, and women especially, to be modest and to dress modestly. We have, for example, the sarcastic treatment of Israelite women by the Old Testament prophets who scorn their vanity and their sensuality. The women of Zion are haughty, walking along with outstretched necks, flirting with their eyes, tripping along with mincing steps, with ornaments jingling on their ankles. Now remember that language now, because we're going to come to it again. In the New Testament, we have Paul in 1 Timothy 2:9. I want women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds, appropriate for women who profess to worship God. Peter, similarly, in 1 Peter 3:3-4, your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair, the wearing of gold jewelry, and fine clothes. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. It's noteworthy that the woman who's sitting on the beast in Revelation 17:4 is decked out in just this way that Peter condemns in 1 Peter 3. It's not for nothing that there are churches, have been churches, and are today churches that are taken, or that have taken the position that makeup and that hairstyling are not permitted to Christian women. We're likewise taught to consider much more important the spiritual character than the physical appearance. Peter made that point in the text we just read, but Proverbs 31:30, charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Then we have a large class of texts warning of the seductive power of sexual temptation, even elaborate descriptions of such temptation underway as those given by the father to his son in Proverbs 5 and 6 and 7. And this special emphasis is continued when the Bible makes a point of the particularly egregious character of this sin. You have the father's terrible warnings to his son of what happens to the young man who fails here in Proverbs 5 through 7, the shame, the death that will overtake him. Or Paul in 1 Corinthians 6:18, flee from sexual immorality. All other sins a man commits are outside his body, but he who sins sexually sins against his own body. And we have, of course, as you know, illustrations of men who have been or were undone by such temptations. Samson, David, and others as well. Flee youthful lusts, warns Paul, and we are shown many times in the Bible why we must do that. We have the Bible's own example of chaste and modest speech in regard to this entire area of life, so unlike our modern world. All things are not benefited by being brought into the light. You expose photographic film to the light, you ruin it. You don't make it better. And that's true with regard to the sexual dimension of life in many ways. And then we have the catalog of sins that we find repeated from time to time in the Bible, the sins that the godly do not commit that the wicked do, the sins that will be punished in hell. And in those catalogs are always to be found sexual sins. So 1 Corinthians 6:9-11, the wicked will not inherit the kingdom of God. Who are the wicked? Sexually immoral, idolaters, adulterers, homosexual offenders, and so on. And in Revelation 21:8, the sexually immoral are placed among the cowardly, the unbelieving, and the murderers, among those who will be cast into the lake of fire at the last day. No wonder if someone might come away from these texts, as countless Christians have through the ages, that believing that the Bible regarded sex and sensuality as a necessary evil, something to be put up with as little as possible for the sake of children being born to the church. Chrysostom, the great patristic preacher, denied that Adam and Eve could have or would have had sexual relations before the fall. Augustine allowed that sexual procreation was lawful, but he thought that sexual passions were always sinful. Origen actually believed that had sin not entered the world, the race would have been propagated in some other way than by sexual union. Some harmless mode of vegetation, as one scholar puts it. Gregory of Nyssa held that Adam and Eve had been created without sexual desire. The reformers, and especially the Puritans, realized that these were mistaken ideas, but even they did not go as far in the celebration of human sensuality and sexuality as the Bible does. In part, I think, because they continued to think of the Song of Songs as a book about the love of Christ for his church, and not as it actually is a poem in praise of erotic love in marriage. The fact is, however, that there is another continuum, or another pole on this continuum of truth concerning human sensuality, and that pole is also frequently addressed and emphatically taught in the pages of Holy Writ. And at first glance, it seems very difficult to reconcile with that first pole represented by all the texts that I've just mentioned, and some of which I have read to you. I heard a Christian college professor recently say that he'd come to be sensitized to the pressure that our society puts on women to be attractive, and concluded that he should never compliment any of his female students by reason of her appearance. But you'd never learn that from the Bible. It's always complimenting women for their appearance. Rebecca was very beautiful. Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. It's not just the face that's being looked at. Esther was lovely in form and features. Abigail, Bathsheba, Tamar, Vashti, Job's daughters, among others, are said to have been beautiful or lovely to look at. Deuteronomy 21:10. When you go to war against your enemies, these are the peoples outside of the promised land, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take captives, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. Well, the assumption is the attraction is physical. It's her appearance. You haven't gotten to know the gal. You don't yet know what kind of sense of humor she has or how taking her personality is. You want her because she's beautiful and lovely to look at. Then there are texts that celebrate the cultivation of beauty and appearance just in the way that Peter and Paul might be supposed to frown on. As universally in human culture, this cultivation of beauty is almost always mentioned in reference to feminine appearance. Cosmetics were used in ancient Israel. I have a mention of it in 2 Samuel 14:2. So far as we can tell, no stigma whatsoever was ever attached to their use per se. Esther used them, and the text seems not to reflect unfavorably on that fact at all. And we can be the more sure of that because of the very positive remarks made in the Bible about jewelry, about perfume. In the Song of Songs, let's turn that up because we're going to look at the song more directly and putting that pole before us. Chapter 1, verses 9 to 11. I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels. We will make you earrings of gold studded with silver. That's what a man says to the woman he is in love with. Look at verse 12. While the king was at his table, my perfume spread its fragrance. Chapter 4, verses 9 and 10. You've stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. Sister was a euphemism for the female lover in ancient Near Eastern love poetry. You've stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. You have the same thing in Proverbs. But look, for example, very quickly at Ezekiel chapter 16, 9 through 14. This is the famous allegory of Christ and the church, or God and his people Israel, in salvation. He's likening her to a young woman and himself to her lover. And in 9 to 14, we begin to read, I bathed you with water and washed the blood from you and put ointments on you. I clothed you with an embroidered dress and put leather sandals on you, the finest, in other words. I dressed you in fine linen, covered you with costly garments. I adorned you with jewelry. I put bracelets on your arms and a necklace around your neck. And I put a ring on your nose, earrings on your ears, a beautiful crown on your head. So you were adorned with gold and silver. Your clothes were of fine linen and costly fabric and embroidered cloth. Your food was fine flour, honey, and olive oil. You became very beautiful and rose to be a queen. And your fame spread among the nations on account of your beauty, because of the splendor I had given you, made your beauty perfect, declares the Sovereign Lord. When was the last time you men took your wives shopping and made sure that they got another dress and that and you picked out another pair of earrings and a necklace and so on? That's what God does with his girlfriends, and that's what you ought to be doing with your wives. Absolutely. It is the way a godly man thinks about the beauty of his wife and commits himself to the cultivation of that beauty. You go home and you say, honey, we're going shopping. And the shopping will be for you. But in any way, you get the point. Here is the Lord dressing Israel up in what seems to be the very way that Paul and Peter forbid. That is the dialectic, and you've got it square in the eyes. You have texts that seem to be the reverse of what you have God himself doing here. Then there are a great many texts that celebrate the erotic attractiveness of men and women, a number of them in Proverbs, which Dr. Waelke reminds us is an earthy book in regard to its teaching about sexuality. For example, consider Proverbs chapter 5, verse 19. In the first part of this chapter, the father has warned his son about the fatal dangers of sexual sin. The strength of the temptations, the prevalence of the temptations, but the fatal danger of succumbing to these temptations. And what's the antidote? And then he says, as he begins in verse 15, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. These are all now well-established metaphors for sexuality, for sexual activity, for sexual intercourse in the ancient Near East. And when we turn to the Song of Songs, we're going to find the same ones employed again. Should your springs, there you go again, overflow in the streets, your streams of water in the public squares. We're talking about sex. Let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed. Fountain, again, we'll get to that in Song of Song. And may you rejoice in the wife of your youth, a loving doe, a graceful deer. May her breasts satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. So the antidote to sexual temptation, this father is telling his son, is an erotically fulfilling marriage. When he says, may her breasts satisfy you always, he's not talking about breasts for the purpose of suckling a child. He's talking about breasts for the sexual delight and stimulation they provide for a male, a man, the husband of this wife. So the father is saying, what I want for my son is a sexually fulfilling marriage. He's never going to be so safe as when he's in a marriage in which the sexual dimension of life is wonderfully expressed and wonderfully fulfilled. You do not go swiping VW bugs off the street when you've got a Cadillac home in your garage. That's exactly the point the Father is making. But preeminently, we have the Song of Songs to sort of represent this pole of the Bible's teaching. Now, the Song is a very interesting book, all the more so because only really in the last few years, I mean the last 4 or 5 years, have we begun really to unlock the key, or the lock, unlock this book. We found the key. You know that chiasmus, or inverted parallelism, is a very common feature in biblical literary structure. And the Song of Songs is a chiasmus. It has parallel sections at both ends, and coming into the middle, one after another, after another. And then there's a central pivot section that has no parallel in the middle of the poem. The pivot begins at 3, verse 6, and it ends at 5, 1. And only in the middle, only in that center section, is the woman referred to as a bride. Every place else, she's a girl and he's a guy who have the hots for one another, and they're desperate to touch one another and kiss one another, but they can't, because they can't yet get married. And so the book is about the difficulty of waiting and the importance of waiting for marriage, for sexual consummation. I won't take the time to demonstrate this to you, but you'll notice, dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. This is 1:5. Do not stare at me because I am dark, because I'm darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. My own vineyard I have neglected. Tell me whom I love, where you graze your flock, where you rest your sheep at midday. She wants to be with him. So she uses the word vineyard in two ways. First of all, because she wants to be with her boyfriend, her brothers. There's no mention of the father in the poem, so it probably originates in a real-life situation. The dad's dead, and so the brothers are now in charge of her life. And they are the ones who have to give her permission to consummate a relationship in marriage. And they think she's too young. So they put her to work on the family farm. She's out in the real vineyard. And the reason she's dark, the reason she's got her tan, is because she's out in the sun all day long working in the vineyard. But she neglects her own vineyard. Now the word being used metaphorically of her heart, of her love, of her relationship with her lover. Go to the very end of the book, chapter 8. Now, I don't know how many of you have had this experience when you're reading through the Bible and you come to the end of the Song of Songs and you have, we have a young sister and her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister? And you're thinking, what in the world does this have to do with anything? But the situation is the same. In a chiasmus, the outer parallels, the outermost sections, the one at the very beginning of the poem and the one at the very end of the poem, are the same. And then you work this way inward. We tend to go this way in the West. Our prose and our poetry is more linear. But in the ancient Near Eastern world, it tended to be chiastic in inverted parallels. So here you have, we have a young sister and her breasts are not yet grown. What shall we do for our sister for the day she's spoken for? If she's a wall, we'll build towers of silver on her. If she's a door, we'll enclose her with panels of cedar. In other words, we're not going to let any guy get his hands on our sister. I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers. Thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. I am sexually mature. He knows it. He wants me. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal Haman. He let out his vineyard to tenants. Now we're talking again about a real vineyard, an actual vineyard. Each was to bring for its fruit 1,000 shekels of silver. But my own vineyard is mine to give. We have vineyard used twice, one in a literal sense and now one in a figurative sense, just like in that first section. But my own vineyard is mine to give. 1,000 shekels are for you, O Solomon, and 200 are for those who tend its fruit. In other words, you've got the same situation. You've got a young woman who wants love, and her brothers won't let her have it. in the first section of the poem and the last section of the poem. When you get up to the central pivot, you'll notice that at 3:1 through 5, you've got a dream sequence. All night long on my bed, I looked for the one my heart loves. I looked for him, but did not find him. She's dreaming. And then at 5:2, right after the central pivot, I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. You've got a dream sequence. You've got one right before the central pivot. You've got one right after the central pivot. You've got a chiasmus here. And the story of the chiasmus, the story of the structure of the poem, is you've got a girl who wants to get married, but she can't yet. She's not being allowed to. The tremendous drive on both the boy's part and the girl's part to be together sexually and having to wait for that until the right time. She says in 8, if only you were to me like a brother who was nursed at my mother's breast, then if I found you outside, I would kiss you and no one would despise me. If you were my brother, you could come to my house and we could be together. But you're not my brother, and so we can't be. Not until we get married. That's the basic structure of the poem. But now, let's look at the details. The song we now know is a collection of erotic poems. And the reason we know that, or really one erotic poem in this particular structure of chiasmus, the reason we know that is because we now have other poems from the same culture and the same time to compare it to. We never did before, but we now do, and it is of a piece with that literature. Its imagery, its language is very typical of the love poems of the time. You know, of course, that through the ages, the church justified the place of the song in the canon by treating it as an allegory of God's love for Israel or Christ's love for the church. It was treated as an account not really about the love of a man and a woman, but that love as a picture of a higher, more important love, the love of Christ for the soul and so on. So you have Gregory the Great making a very typical statement. Kisses are named and breasts, cheeks, thighs are named in this book. By these words, the sacred discourse is not made ridiculous. We learn in the expression of this our own love, the ardor with which we should burn for the love of God. Gregory thought that if the song was really about human erotic love, it would be in some respect ridiculous to have it in the Bible. But of course, that is what the book is about. Now, people will sometimes say, well, still, we can treat it as, because after all, elsewhere in the Bible, God does liken his relationship to us as a relationship like that between a husband and a wife, or a groom and a bride, and so on. But the fact of the matter is, the text that the Song of Songs is most like in the Bible is Proverbs chapter 5. And nobody treats Proverbs chapter 5 as an allegory of Christ and the church. It's simply a category mistake to treat the song in that way. And the proof of it is that even if you take it as an allegory, you have two fatal problems. And these problems have surfaced time and time and time and time again in the interpretation of the book. The first problem, and perhaps the most fatal, is that the love described in the book is not agape. It is not love in spite of. It's not love in defiance of. It is very much eros, love because of. If you're going to take your theology of salvation out of the Song of Songs, then the answer to the question, why did Christ love me, is because I was so beautiful and because I was so lovable, and we know that's not right. That's not a fair interpretation of the song. But the other is that in an uninterpreted and unidentified allegory, it's impossible to know what anything means. Now, the Pilgrim's Progress is an allegory, but nobody has any difficulty understanding it because Bunyan tells you what everything means. His character's name is Christian. He runs into Mr. Worldly Wise Man, and he has to pass through the Slough of Despond, and he goes to Vanity Fair, and he passes through the Delectable Mountains and all these things. He tells you what everything means. But in an uninterpreted allegory, nobody knows what anything means. So my favorite example is chapter 1, verse 13, where she says, "My lover is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts." Well, Origen took that to be a reference to Christ between the Old and the New Testament. But how would you know? How would you know it wasn't a thousand other things instead of that? So let's abandon that and consider ourselves the better off. There are plenty of places in the Bible that teach us God's love for his people and Christ for the church. And there are a few other places that teach us exactly what we're being taught here in the Song of Songs. It's not the only place where you get this, but it's certainly where you get it in the most consistent and beautiful form. Now, the song is about the love of man and woman with a strong accent on the sensual. Chapter 1, verse 2. Love and wine are brought together. Your love is more delightful than wine. The basis of that comparison is that both things produce very pleasing physical sensations. This is love with physical connotations, not just broader, more abstract romantic attraction. And you have that juxtaposition of wine or beer and love in other ancient Near Eastern love poems. One text from the Cairo Love Songs, the date from 1300 to 1100 BC, so a little bit earlier than the song, reads, "I embrace her and her arms open wide. I am like a man in Punt." Punt was a town on the Somali coast known for its myrrh trees. "I am like a man in Punt, like someone overwhelmed with drugs. I kiss her, her lips open, and I am drunk without beer." And that's the idea here. Your love is more delightful than wine. Or consider verse 9 of chapter 1. "I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh." Now, when the song was being interpreted allegorically, you would typically get explanations along this line, that ancient Near Eastern people loved their horses the way we love our pets, our dogs and our cats, and so on. They had this very strong attraction to them. And they thought women horses, female horses, were more beautiful than male horses. They supposed that must be the case. But of course, that isn't what it is talking about at all. We now know that. Chariots were pulled by stallions. In almost every ancient Near Eastern army, stallions pulled chariots. A mare, in fact, there was even a battle tactic in which you let mares loose into the chariot forces of your enemy, because of course the horses would get distracted and would forget about what they were supposed to be doing. He's talking about the fact that stallions lose contact with all their other responsibilities when they happen to be in the presence of a mare. And that's what he's saying. You distract me. I can't keep my eyes off you. I can't stop thinking about you. And he's really talking about the way she looks and how pretty she is and how much he wants to be with her and to touch her and to kiss her and so on. So this is the burden of this book. Consider the descriptions of the man, of which there is one, and of the woman, of which there are three in the song. They're all highly erotic descriptions of the human form. The woman in 4:1-7, who's described from her head to her chest. The man in 5:10-16. The woman again in 6:4-9, only her head is described. And then in 7:1-9, from her feet to her head. And the sexual character of the description is obvious beyond doubt. So in chapter 7, "How beautiful you are," verse 6, how pleasing, O love, with your delights. Your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit. May your breasts be like the clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples. This is a highly erotic description of her body. And one of the interesting things, of course, about this is it's all metaphorical. You could read this text, and it was read at Passover. It was the short, each of the five megalot, or short scrolls in the Old Testament, were read at a particular holiday in the Old Testament liturgical calendar, and the Song of Songs was read at Passover. And so the men and the women who know what all these metaphors stand for, they're getting red in the face and they're nudging one another and so on. But the kids, they think you're talking about horticulture and gardening and so on. They're completely unaware of what the subject of the book actually is. And then take note of the chaste explicitness of the description of sexual desire in chapter 4, verses 9 through 15. Read some of that already. And take note of the imagery. It's all the imagery we already found in Proverbs 5. We'll start at 11. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up. Garden is an ancient Near Eastern love poem metaphor for the woman as an object of sexual desire, or even for the female genitals. There's a poem in which the king is plowing his garden. My sister, my bride, you are a spring enclosed. Remember, let your springs not flow in the streets. A sealed fountain. May your fountain be blessed, the father said in Proverbs 5. But here, you're a garden locked up. You're a spring enclosed. You're a fountain sealed. So this is still virginity. He's still not able yet to enjoy the pleasures of sex with her. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes, and all the finest spices. Those are aphrodisiacs. Now, in our present culture, we'd say something else. We'd say, I've got satin sheets on my waterbed, and I've got Bolero playing on the CD, or something of that sort. But the interesting thing about verses 13 and 14 is that if you go to Proverbs chapter 7, where the father gives his son an account of the wiles of a prostitute, he takes him into the red light district, he points out a prostitute to him, shows how she dresses and why she dresses that way to lure him into her net and so on and so forth. He describes her using some of the same aphrodisiacs that are mentioned here in the purity of premarital romance and love and the anticipation of sexual consummation in marriage. It's the Bible's way of saying, Playboy doesn't know anything about sex that Christian men and women aren't supposed to know. It's not as though somehow or another we're supposed to be rubes at this and have no idea about lingerie that cultivates sexual passion and sexual pleasure. We're supposed to be as sophisticated as anybody else. The difference is that we keep our sexual living within the boundaries marked out by the Word of God and the law of God, so that our sexual lovemaking, our passion, our enjoyment of this dimension of life is life-giving and not deadly and destructive and ruinous to our lives and the lives of others. Then he goes on. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. And then these two important verses, 4:16 and 5:1. Finally, and only in the poem, you get sexual consummation. Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden. You know, there is a magnificent hymn in the first edition of Trinity Hymnal on this text by Isaac Watts on the revival of the church. Christ hath a garden walled around a paradise of fruitful ground. Soon as you understand what is really being talked about here, it is very hard to sing that hymn with a straight face, beautiful a hymn as it is. Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden, that its fragrance may spread abroad. She's speaking now, of course. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. In other words, they've gotten married, and this is the wedding night. And lest you mistake the place of erotic sexual consummation in this poem, the author has put it, chapter divisions in the Song of Songs are worthless. They're often inept in the Bible. But here they are completely, completely worthless. The author has put sexual consummation in the exact middle of his poem. There are 111 lines of poetry before 4:16. There are 111 lines of poetry after 5:1. That's the middle. That's what everything is working toward from the outside in when they finally are able to consummate their relationship sexually. That's what the book is about. We had virginity, now we have sexual consummation. So you have this erotic fixation on one another. You have this elaborate interest in the way one another looks. You have the cultivation of beauty with earrings and cosmetics and perfume and the cultivation of desire in all of these ways. Her desire and his desire as well. And that you have at one pole, when the other pole is all of those texts I mentioned at the beginning about chastity, about modesty, about spiritual beauty, about all the things that the scripture emphasizes with respect to the, as it were, the subjugation of this particular dimension and aspect of life. Now, the point of this dialectic, as with all the dialectics we've considered and all the ones we might consider, is this. God does not summon us to be partially modest and spiritually minded and partially lusty and erotically fixated on our spouse. He calls us to be both. He warns us against the pride that accompanies beauty. Simone Weil, the French Roman Catholic philosopher, said in what I think is a very profound observation and one a man ought particularly to understand and resonate with in regard to the life of the women in his life, his wife and his daughters. Simone Weil was not an attractive woman. She was quite a plain woman. She wrote, "A beautiful woman looking at her image in the mirror may very well believe the image is herself. An ugly woman knows that it is not." That's a very important thing to remember about women. They live under a pressure that we do not live under. And that pressure is extraordinarily difficult to carry day in, day out, month in, month out, year in, year out. And the only thing that makes it really fun, this whole dimension of life, the only thing that makes it really fun for a woman is to be married to a man who obviously thinks she's beautiful, cares about her beauty, wants to cultivate it himself, and is constantly telling her how beautiful she is in his mind. So the Bible warns us of the grave danger to our godliness, our salvation, our very lives in this world that sexual temptation and sexual sin pose. Absolutely forbids sexual activity outside of marriage. And it's a great worry nowadays how many evangelical Christian single young people are admitting to being promiscuous. But our Father in heaven obviously intends for us to enjoy his good gifts. He has made us sexual beings, and in his word, he celebrates not just sexual intercourse as a way of producing children, but the whole erotic dimension of life as a source and center of tremendous personal fulfillment and pleasure and joy. There is nothing more safe, and there is nothing that more regularly blesses a Christian life with joy, let's be honest, than happy eroticism in our marriages. That's what every father wants for his son. He wants for his boy a gal who, when they are married, so completely satisfies that dimension of his life for him that it will never occur to him to go somewhere else sinfully to receive those pleasures instead of righteously to enjoy them safely in his own home and in his own bed. Chastity is abstinence from sex before one is married and the enthusiastic practice of it after one is married. Both of them are chastity. It was the huge mistake of the Christian church to allow the term chastity to become attached to a sexless life. Chastity in the Bible is abstinence from sex before you're married and the enthusiastic practice of it after you're married. Now, You cannot synthesize these emphases. You cannot easily explain in a sentence what Paul means by saying, I don't want a woman to braid her hair or wear jewelry, and then to hear God dressing up Israel, fixing her hair, and loading her down with jewelry. Or the Song of Songs talking about how her jewelry just captured me and kept me from thinking about anything else, or the smell of her perfume and so on. You cannot easily reconcile those two things, but they are both emphatically, plainly taught in the Bible. We're not to be half modest and half lusty. We're supposed to be all modest and all lusty. And out of that comes a godly life and a blessing, not only of ourselves, but of our wives and our children. Amen.